This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren.
Tonight, James Cagney in Art Jobler's dramatization of the most talked of book of the year, Johnny Got His Gun by Dalton Trumbull.
We tell you of Joe Bonham. 22 years ago, he went to war. They carried him back from that war. They carried him back because he had no arms, no legs, no ears with which to hear, no eyes with which to see, no mouth with which to speak. Today, he lies alone in a room in a hospital close to your city. He's a living flesh, and he waits. Your world is shut off from Joe Bonham. He has only the world within his own mind. We tell you of Joe Bonham. These are the thoughts of a boy who 22 years ago went to war.
Somebody listen to me. I'm talking to you. Somebody listen to me. Gotta talk to somebody. It's dark and lonely. Somebody... No. Going out of my head again. How can you hear what ain't got a tongue, ain't got a mouth, ain't got... No, won't think of that anymore. Gotta think of something, yeah, something else. If I don't think, my head, yeah, quick, think about when I was a kid.
Hey, Joe, come on in swimming.
Yeah, swimming. When I was a kid, I went swimming. Dive in the river, feel the water against my legs and my arms. Now I haven't got any No, won't think of that. Think about... My town.
It's the nicest little old place on earth, Shale City.
I gotta remember.
Hamburger, get your hot hamburger, get your hot hamburger.
Yeah, best hamburgers in the world.
All right, boy, here's 30 cents. Go down and get 3 hamburgers.
Pa.
Oh, they're delicious. If I could only cook like this.
Ma, she... No. No, don't think of her. Think about... County Fair.
See the lady cut in half the fourth part of a dollar.
On a second rider, defying death inside a street up and down circular wall.
I can't remember anymore. I gotta remember. I gotta. If I don't remember things, I'll think. And if I think... No. I gotta remember something. Something. Girls. Think about girls. Quick, think about girls.
Joe.
Kareem.
Joe, I'm scared. I'm so scared.
No.
Kiss me. Hold me.
We shouldn't have turned the lights out. Your old man will be sore.
He understands.
Your lips.
Don't go. They'll kill you.
I gotta go. When you're drafted, you gotta.
Oh, Joe. Joe, I don't want you to go. Hold me. Tight. Maybe we'll never get another chance. Now, Joe. In your arms, Joe. In your arms. In your arms.
My arms. My arms.
What? What?
Joe, hold me. Don't go, Joe.
Get your gun, get your gun, get your gun.
Joe, I'm part of you now. Don't go, Joe. No. Hold me, Joe. Hold me. Both your arms tight around me. Both your arms tight around me. Both your arms tight around me. Both your arms.
No, stop. My arms... I haven't got any arms. You hear me, Kareem? I haven't got any arms.
haven't got any arms.
What's the matter with me? I didn't find it out yesterday or the day before. It was
1939, 1938, 1937.
A long time ago.
Joe.
Kareen, you're still in my head. I'll tell you as if you were here. Here's how I found out everything about myself. I woke up like out of a dream. It was like I was in the water. I tried to swim, but I didn't have any arms. I started to kick my legs to float up in the air out of the bed. But I couldn't kick. I didn't have any legs. I threw my head back. I started to yell. I only started. But how can you yell when you haven't got a... I began to reach out, Karine. The only way I could reach out. With the nerves of my skin. The hole in my face. Feel the skin creeping around the edge of it. It went... I was blind. What a lousy dream. Nobody could live like that. Just dream, and that's all. But it wasn't a dream. It wasn't a dream. Mother. Mother, where are you? Hurry, Mother. Hurry, 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 and wake me up. I'm having a nightmare, Mother. Where are you? Mother, listen to me. I can't stand it. Mother, please, please, tell me it's not me, not me. Not me, no, no, not me. Oh, please, not me. That's the way I found out. A long time ago. Who was I telling that to?
Joe.
Oh, Karine. Still in my head. In my heart. Now I'll tell you about how I found out about time. About the days. Knowing about the days you're living through, that's important, see? But all I remembered was... died in the dugout and then... That was all. A day in September 1918. And that's all. Time stopped then. Start time over again. But how could I catch hold of time when I was caught inside myself? Vibrations. I had it. When the nurse came into the room... the vibration of her footsteps running up through the floor, through the bed, through the springs of the bed, into me. All I had to do was count the seconds, then the minutes, then the hours between each visit she made, until I had 24 hours counted up in my head. And after that, I'd be able to figure the days out just by counting up her visits. One day, the minute the nurse left me, I began to count.
One, two, three,
second by second, four, second five, by second. Six, when seven, I counted 60... eight, that meant a minute, as nearly as I was able to figure it. But I always lost count. I'd think of something else, then I'd lose count again.
One, two, one, two.
Day after day after day, but I could never keep track. I couldn't. I couldn't. And all the time, the days were running away from me. And then, one day it happened. The skin on the side of my neck... the half of a forehead above the mask. Lying there all the years gone by, I got to thinking that maybe there was some way I could use those pieces of skin. Skin free to the air. They were healthy. I got to thinking what a man did with his skin.
To feel with.
But that didn't seem enough.
To sweat with.
Yeah, sweat with. Hot and cold.
Sunrise and sunset.
Just like that. The idea came into my head just like that. All I had to do was to feel with my skin. When it changed from cool to warm on that little piece of skin, it'd be sunrise and the beginning of a day. I got to thinking about the nurse and how many visits she made me each day and when she made them. Yeah, I'd better start with the nurse. She changes the bedding. In a hospital, they must change bedding in the morning, maybe around 8 o'clock. So all I got to do is wait till she changes the bedclothes. That'll mean it's morning. Then wait, maybe... 18, 20 hours, and that'll be next morning. That'll be sunrise. You can feel the heat of sunrise against your skin, yeah. So, I waited until the next time she changed the bedding. She walked away. Calm down, because you haven't proved anything yet. Calm down and wait and count her visits. Number two, I dozed off and woke. Visit number 3. Time got all mixed up. Then 4, and then... the 5th time. Now all of a sudden, I knew it was happening. My heart stopped. My breath stopped. I knew it was happening. Slow at first, crawling along my skin. Warmer and warmer. The rising sun. In my room. In my room. I'd won. I caught up with time again. The sun. It was dawn. It was dawn for the world and for me. I could smell the dawn. Yeah, me without a face lying there. And the smell of the dew on the grass. And me without eyes, shading my eyes and seeing the sun coming up over the mountains back home. And the hills going pink and lavender like the inside of a seashell. The sun warming my little piece of skin. And me seeing without eyes the town where I was born. And me without ears hearing the lowing of the cows waiting to be milked. And babies kicking in their cribs and rubbing their eyes with their fists. It's sunrise. And I've got it. And now I'll always know when it's sunrise. And they can't take it away from me. Thank you, God. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. I may never have anything else, but I'll always have dawn and the morning sunlight. A year went by fast. I was a busy guy. I learned a lot. Yeah, could even tell my nurses apart. The day nurse always walked to the bed with 4 steps. She was always the same, but the night nurses seemed to change. One of them... must have cried when she looked at me. I felt her tears wet on me. I like to think she was young and beautiful. But every night, summer and winter, week in and week out, month in and month out, every night I was with you, Karine. With you, darling. My arms around you, yours around me. With you, Karine.
Joe, my darling.
Close to you.
My dearest.
My arms around you.
My lover.
And yours around me.
Mine.
With you, Karine.
Oh, Joe.
2 years went by after I discovered time. 3 years went by after I discovered time. The 4th year started awfully slow. One day I felt vibrations. Vibrations heavier and heavier, and then they stopped. I knew they were standing around the bed. After all these years, visitors. And all at once, crazy thoughts went through my head.
It may be your mother.
No.
Karine.
No, not Karine. Not Karine standing by my bed. You can't see me. Not this way. Not you, Karine. Go away. Go away. Go away. Go away. Go away. Go away. Then a hand came to rest on my forehead. Man's hand.
Doctor's.
Yes. Maybe doctors come to examine me. Somebody was touching at my nightshade over my left breast. The cloth fell back against my chest again. It was heavy now, weighed down by something. Medal. They've given me a medal. Me, a medal. Me, a medal. Me! The generals were here, around my bed. The generals. The big guys, the famous guys who still had arms and legs and could still see and talk and smell and taste. In my throat, I felt a tearing of something that used to be a voice. I was talking to them, and they couldn't hear me. I was saying, listen, big guys, I'm lying here like a side of beef. And for what?
War. We're going to war.
Yeah, someone said that, so I went. But why? Why? Somebody just said...
let's go out and fight for liberty.
Liberty? What kind of liberty? How much liberty and whose idea of liberty? A guy says, come on, let's fight for liberty. And he can't show you liberty. If you're going to die for liberty, you've got to know in advance what liberty is and whose idea of liberty they're talking about and just how much of that liberty we're going to have. Maybe that's a bad way to think.
The big guys say it's bad, and I heard them. In the schools and the newspapers and the legislature and the congresses, that's their business. They sound wonderful.
This ground is sanctified by blood. They shall not have died in vain.
Our noble dead.
But I'm asking you, big guys, what do the dead say? Did any one of them ever come back and say...
I'm glad I'm dead, because death is always better than dishonor.
Did they say...
I'm glad I died to make the world safer democracy.
Nobody but the dead know whether all these things people talk about are worth dying for or not. And the dead can't talk. So the words about noble death and sacred blood and honor and such are all put into dead lips by those that got no right to speak for the dead. I'm asking you, big guys, how did they feel about it just before they died? Did all those guys die thinking of democracy and freedom and liberty and honor? You know they didn't. They died crying in their minds like little kids. They died crying for the face of a friend. They died crying for the voice of a mother or father or wife or baby. They died moaning and crying for life. I know. I'm the nearest thing to a dead man on earth. There's nothing bigger than life. What's noble about having your legs and arms blown off? What's noble about being blind and deaf and dumb? I'm dead, big guys, and I died for nothing. You hear me? Nothing, nothing. You hear me, big guys? But they didn't hear me. Just as you couldn't hear me, Karine, if you were standing next to me. All the generals heard was the blowing of the air in the tube in my throat. When I heard the vibrations of the footsteps that said they were going, I began to think. The vibrations. Up to now, I thought only of the vibrations coming to me. How about making my vibrations go to them? Yes, vibrations to them. A footstep on the floor is a kind of vibration. The tap of a telegraph key is another kind. I had it. I had it. When I was a kid, Bill Harper and me, we had a telegraph set. Used to telegraph to each other. Dot, dash, dot, dash, dot, dash, dot. I remember the code, the Morse code. All I had to do to break through to Pete, to the people outside, was to lie in bed and dot, dash to the nurse. I could give messages and receive messages. I raised my head from my pillow. I dropped it. Then I did it twice quickly. That was it. With my head, raise my head, let it fall on the pillow. The Morse code. S-O-S, help. I tapped it out of my pillow with my head. S-O-S, all over the world, that meant help. S-O-S, help, help. Then the door of the room jarred open and the nurse's footsteps came up to the bed. S-O-S, S-O-S, over and over again. She was looking at me. I knew it, I knew it. S-O-S, help me. S-O-S, help me. S-O-S, oh, why can't you understand? S-O-S, help me. S-O-S, help me. S-O-S, S-O-S. Help me, S-O-S, help me. S-O-S. My head full of it. Help tapping me. It out with my head over and over. Over and over. S-O-S. Couldn't stop. Why won't they hear me? Why won't they understand? Why won't they hear me? Karine, why? No. There isn't any, Karine. There isn't nothing. I've been talking in my head. There's nothing for me. Nothing.
S.O.S.
I don't know what day it is.
S.O.S.
I don't know
help
what
me.
Month it is.
S-O-S.
I don't know what
help
year it is.
S-O-S.
I've been tapping for years and years and nobody hears
help me.
S-O-S. Nobody, nobody,
S-O-S.
Nobody. Someone's come into the room. Footstep right. I... Regular day nurse. Hers are heavy. Who's this one? Start tapping now. What? What is this one doing? Opening the nightshirt. She's moving the tip of her finger against my skin. What? Drawing something. Huh? I know. The letter M. I know. Shake my head. Yes, yes, I know, I know. I understand. It's M. Wonderful M. Writing something else on my skin. E. Yes, yes, I got that. R. Yes. Another R. Yes. Now what? Why? Nothing more. M-E-R-R-Y. Mary. Writing again. C-H-R-I-S-T-M-A-S. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Yes, nurse, I understand. Nodding my head to tell you I understand. I can't say it so you can hear me, but in my heart I'm saying it. Merry Christmas, nurse. God bless you. Bells in my town. I'm hearing them in my head, nurse.
T'was the night before Christmas.
Mother.
And all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse.
Mother, I hear you.
The stockings were hung by the chimney with care, in a hope that St. Nicholas too would be there.
Every Christmas Eve, I remember.
He sprang to his sleigh, to his team, gave a whistle, and away they all flew like down from a thistle. But I heard him explain ere he drove out of sight, Merry Christmas to all, and to all a good night.
Merry Christmas, Mother. Merry Christmas, Mother. Nurse. New nurse. Smart nurse. She'll pay attention to me. Old nurse didn't understand. New nurse, you've got to understand. Tappan, I'll start. There, nurse. I did it. Did you understand it? 3, 2, and 3. S-O-S. Did you understand it? I'll do it again. Morse code. You understand? Morse code. Watch, nurse, watch. If I had a tongue, if I had a mouth, I'd yell it at you. I'd scream it at you. But I have nothing but the tapping of my head. So watch, nurse, watch. If you turn and walk out of the room and never come back, you will be carrying my life with you. Your life and death to me, nurse. Look, I'll tap it again. See? S-O-S. Help me. S-O-S. Oh, I'll do it again. I'm praying now, nurse. Me, just an ordinary guy, I'm praying. Oh, please, God, make her understand what I'm trying to tell her. Please, God, make her understand. I know you're a busy guy. I know there are millions of people praying to you every minute. I know all these things, God, and I don't blame you for getting behind in your orders. Nobody's perfect, but what I want is such a little thing. All I want you to do is to take a tiny little idea that's in my mind and put it in her mind 2, maybe 3 feet away. That's all I want, God. Just a little idea that's in my mind and put it in her mind. It's such a little thing, God. Such a little thing. She's going away. She's gone out of the room. No, no, can't be true. Can't shove me down under the ground again, bury me deep again. No, no, I won't believe it, I won't. I won't start crying now. She'll come back. She's my life. She's my chance at life. She will come back. She will, she will, she will. Door. She's back. Brought someone with her. Man's finger on my head. What? Finger tapping on my head. Tapping out W. H. Tapping out the code on my head. A. T. W. H. A. T. What? D. O. Y. O. U. Y. O. U. U. W. A. N. T. W. A. N. T. What do you want? What do I want? What do I want? What do I want? I want to get out. Let me out. That's all I want. I've been lying here for years and years in a room and a bed with a little covering of skin. Now I want out. I've got to get out. If I had legs, I could run away. I could get away. I could get out into the open where there's air, where there's room, where I'm not in a hole and smothering. Inside me, I scream and howl and push and fight for room and air for escape from the smothering, from the loneliness. So, let me out of here and take me back into the world. No. I didn't tap that out. What I just said, I only was thinking. Won't say it to you waiting up there, no. Before I ask you up there, before I tap it out with my head, I've got to think out just what I'm going to tell you. It may be my last chance. I've got it. I've got it. Listen, you up there. I'm tapping it out with my head. Let me out of here. Let me out of here. Let me out. I can earn my keep. I can do a job like anyone else. Take me out of here and build a glass case for me so people can see me. Take me in my glass case to the beaches, to the county fairs and the church bazaars and the circuses and the traveling carnivals. You'll do a wonderful business with me, and I could pay you for the trouble. They've never seen nothing like me. I'm something you can really holler about. I'm the dead man who's alive. The live man who's dead. I'm the man who made the world safe for democracy. Take me into the places where men work and make things. Take me there and say, boys, here's a cheap way to get by. Maybe times are bad and your salaries are low. Don't worry, boys, because you'll have your chance. There'll be another war along pretty soon, and then maybe you'll be lucky like me. Take me into the schoolhouses, all the schoolhouses in the world. They'll scream at first and have nightmares at night, but they'll get used to it because they've got to get used to it. And it's best to start them young. Take me into the colleges and universities and academies and convents. Call the girls together, all the healthy, beautiful young girls. Point to me and say, girls, here is your father. Look, girls, here is your lover. Call all the young men together and say, here is your brother, here is your best friend, and here are you, young men. Take me wherever there are parliaments and diets and congresses and chambers of statesmen. I want to be there when they talk about honor and justice and making the world safe. Put my glass case upon the speaker's desk, and every time the gavel drops, let me feel its vibration through my little glass case. Then let them draft notes and ultimatums and protests and accusations. But before they vote on them, before they give the order for all the little guys to start killing each other, let the main guy wrap his gavel on my case and point down at me and say, gentlemen, here is the only issue before this house, and that is, are you for this thing here, or are you against it? And if they are against it, then let them stand up like men and vote. And if they are for it, let them be hanged and drawn and quartered and paraded through the streets and thrown out into the fields where no clean animal will touch them. And may no green thing ever grow where they rot. Take me into your churches, your great towering cathedrals, which have to be rebuilt every 50 years because they are destroyed by war. Carry me in my glass box down the aisles where kings and priests and brides and children at their confirmations have gone so many times before to kiss a splinter of wood from a true cross on which was nailed the body of a man who was lucky enough to die. Set me high on your altars and call on God to look down upon his murderous little children, his dearly beloved little children. Then bring in the fierce ones, the spawners of hate, the inventors of slogans. Bring them in and make them look at me, and then dare them. Dare them to break the peace.
Ladies and gentlemen, tonight we have brought you James Cagney playing the leading role in Dalton Trumbo's memorable novel of the year, Johnny Got His Gun. The book was dramatized for radio by Arch Oberle. The musical score was written, conducted by Gordon Jenkins.
An oft-repeated idea is that democracy requires that the people be well-informed. It is generally supposed that free universal education exists to contribute toward this end. Over the months, I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education, and a different picture is emerging. The designers of America's compulsory system were not out to produce a nation of sharp minds, but a brave new world of obedient people who know their place. This week, in our reading, we examine Prussia, the source of the schooling model that was consciously brought to America, a schooling model designed for a society devoted to militarism and war. We begin Chapter 7, The Prussian Connection, from John Taylor Gatto's Underground History of American Education. He begins with this description of Prussian fire discipline from the Encyclopedia Britannica 11th edition on Prussia. On approaching the enemy, the marching columns of Prussians wheeled in succession to the right or left, passing along the front of the enemy until the rear company had wheeled. Then the whole together wheeled into line, facing the enemy. These movements brought the infantry into two long, well-closed lines. Parade ground precision obtained thanks to remorseless drilling. With this movement was bound up a fire discipline more extraordinary than any perfection of maneuver. Peloton Feuer was opened at 200 paces from the enemy and continued up to 30 paces when the line fell on with a bayonet. The possibility of this combination of fire and movement was the work of Leopold, who by sheer drill made the soldier a machine capable of delivering, with flintlock muzzle-loading muskets, 5 volleys a minute. The special Prussian fire discipline gave an advantage of 5 shots to 2 against all opponents. The bayonet attack, if the rolling volleys had done their work, was merely presenting the check for payment, as a German writer put it. The particular utopia American believers chose to bring to the schoolhouse was Prussian. The seed that became American schooling 20th century style was planted in 1806 when Napoleon's amateur soldiers bested the professional soldiers of Prussia at the Battle of Jena. When your business is renting soldiers and employing diplomatic extortion under threat of your soldiery, losing a battle like that is pretty serious. Something had to be done. The most important immediate reaction to Jena was an immortal speech, the Address to the German Nation, by the philosopher Fichte, one of the influential documents of modern history leading directly to the first workable compulsion schools in the West. Other times, other lands talked about schooling, but all failed to deliver. Simple force training for brief intervals and for narrow purposes was the best that had ever been managed. This time would be different. In no uncertain terms, Fichte told Prussia the party was over. Children would have to be disciplined through a new form of universal conditioning. They could no longer be trusted to their parents. Look what Napoleon had done by banishing sentiment in the interests of nationalism. Through forced schooling, everyone would learn that work makes free. And working for the state, even laying down one's life to its commands, was the greatest freedom of all. Here in the genius of semantic redefinition lay the power to cloud men's minds, a power later packaged and sold by public relations pioneers Edward Bernays and Ivy Lee in the seed time of American forced schooling. Prior to Fichte's challenge, any number of compulsion school proclamations had rolled off printing presses here and there, including Martin Luther's plan to tie church and state together this way, and of course the old Deluder Satan Law of 1642 in Massachusetts and its 1645 extension. The problem was these earlier ventures were virtually unenforceable, roundly ignored by those who smelled mischief lurking behind fancy promises of free education. People who wanted their kids schooled had them schooled even then. People who didn't, didn't. That was more or less true for most of us right into the 20th century. As late as 1920, only 32% of American kids went past elementary school. If that sounds impossible, consider the practice in Switzerland today, where only 23% of the student population goes to high school, though Switzerland has the world's highest per capita income. Prussia was prepared to use bayonets on its own people as readily as it wielded them against others. So it's not all that surprising the human race got its first effective secular compulsion schooling out of Prussia in 1819, the same year Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, set in the darkness of far-off Germany, was published in England. Schule came after more than a decade of deliberations, commissions, testimony, and debate. For a brief hopeful moment, Humboldt's brilliant arguments for a high-level, no-holds-barred, free-swinging, universal, intellectual course of study for all, full of variety, free debate, rich experience, and personalized curricula almost won the day. What a different world we would have today if Humboldt had won the Prussian debate. But the forces backing Baron von Stein won instead, and that has made all the difference. The Prussian mind, which carried the day, held a clear idea of what centralized schooling should deliver. 1. Obedient soldiers to the army. 2. Obedient workers for mines, factories, and farms. 3. Well-subordinated civil servants trained in their function. 4. Well-subordinated clerks for industry. 5. Citizens who thought alike on most issues. 6. National uniformity in thought, word, and deed. The area of individual volition for commoners was severely foreclosed by Prussian psychological training procedures drawn from the experience of animal husbandry and equestrian training, and also taken from past military experience. Much later, in our own time, the techniques of these assorted crafts and sullen arts became discoveries in the pedagogical pseudoscience of psychological behaviorism. Prussian schools delivered everything they promised. Every important matter could now be confidently worked out in advance by leading families and institutional heads, because well-schooled masses would concur with a minimum of opposition. This tightly schooled consensus in Prussia eventually combined the kaleidoscopic German principalities into a united Germany, after 1,000 years as a nation in fragments. What a surprise the world would soon get from this successful experiment in national centralization. Under Prussian state socialism, private industry surged, vaulting resource-poor Prussia up among world leaders. Military success remained Prussia's touchstone, even before the school law went into full effect as an enhancer of state priorities. The Army Corps under Blücher was the principal reason for Napoleon's defeat at Waterloo, its superb discipline allowing for a surprisingly successful return to combat after what seemed to be a crushing defeat at the little corporal's hands just days before. Unschooled, the Prussians were awesome. Conditioning in the classroom promised to make them even more formidable. The immense prestige earned from this triumph reverberated through an America not so lucky in its own recent fortunes of war, a country humiliated by a shabby showing against the British in the War of 1812. Even 30 years after Waterloo, so highly was Prussia regarded in America and Britain, the English-speaking adversaries selected the Prussian king to arbitrate our northwest border with Canada. Hence the Pennsylvania town King of Prussia. 33 years after Prussia made state schooling work, we borrowed the structure, style, and intention of those Germans for our own first compulsion schools. Traditional American school purpose, piety, good manners, basic intellectual tools, self-reliance, etc., was scrapped to make way for something different. Our historical destination of personal independence gave way slowly to Prussian purpose schooling. Not because the American way lost in any competition of ideas, but because for the new commercial and manufacturing hierarchs, such a course made better economic sense. This private advance toward nationalized schooling in America was partially organized, although little has ever been written about it. Orestes Brownson's journal identifies a covert national apparatus to which Brownson briefly belonged, already in place in the decade after the War of 1812, one whose stated purpose was to Germanize America, beginning in those troubled neighborhoods where the urban poor huddled and where disorganized new immigrants made easy targets, according to Brownson. Enmity on the part of the old stock, middle-class and working-class populations toward newer immigrants gave these unfortunates no appeal against the school sentence to which Massachusetts assigned them. They were in for a complete makeover, like it or not. Much of the story, as it was being written by 1844, lies just under the surface of Mann's florid prose in his 7th annual report to the Boston School Committee. On a visit to Prussia the year before, he'd been much impressed, so he said, with the ease by which Prussian calculations could determine precisely how many thinkers, problem solvers, and working stiffs the state would require over the coming decade. Then how it offered the precise categories of training required to develop the percentages of human resource needed. All this was much fairer to man than England's repulsive episcopal system, schooling based on social class. Prussia, he thought, was republican in the desirable, manly, Roman sense. Massachusetts must take the same direction. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. In 1876, before setting off from America to Germany to study, William H. Welch, an ambitious young Bostonian, told his sister, quote, "If by absorbing German lore I can get a little start of a few thousand rivals and thereby reduce my competition a few hundred more or less, it is a good point to tally," close quote. Welch did go off to Germany for the coveted Ph.D., a degree which, at the time, had its actual existence in any practical sense only there, and in due course his ambition was satisfied. Welch became the first dean of Johns Hopkins Medical School, and later chief advisor to the Rockefeller Foundation on medical projects. Welch was one of thousands who found the German Ph.D. a blessing without parallel in late 19th century America. German Ph.D.s ruled the academic scene by then. Prussia itself was a curious place, not an ordinary country, unless you consider ordinary a land which, by 1776, required women to register each onset of their monthly menses with the police. North America had been interested in Prussian developments since long before the American Revolution, its social controls being a favorite subject of discussion among Ben Franklin's exclusive private discussion group, the Junta. When the phony Prussian Baron von Steuben directed bayonet drills for the colonial army, interest rose even higher. Prussia was a place to watch, an experimental state totally synthetic like our own, having been assembled out of lands conquered in the last crusade. For a full century, Prussia acted as our mirror, showing elite America what we might become with discipline. In 1839, 13 years before this first successful school compulsion law was passed in the United States, a perpetual critic of Boston Whig leadership charged that proposals to erect German-style teacher seminaries in this country were a thinly disguised attack on local and popular autonomy. The critic Brownson allowed that state regulation of teaching licenses was a necessary preliminary only if school were intended to serve as a psychological control mechanism for the state and as a screen for a controlled economy. If that was the game truly afoot, said Brownson, it should be reckoned an act of treason. Where the whole tendency of education is to create obedience, Brownson said, all teachers must be pliant tools of government. Such a system of education is not inconsistent with the theory of Prussian society, but the whole thing is inadmissible here. He further argued that according to our theory, the people are wiser than the government. Here the people do not look to the government for light, for instruction, but the government looks to the people. The people give law to the government, close quote. He concluded that to entrust government with the power of determining education which our children shall receive is entrusting our servant with the power of the master. The fundamental difference between the United States and Prussia has been overlooked by the Board of Education and its supporters. Close quote. The same notion of German influence on American institutions occurred recently to a historian from Georgetown, Dr. Carol Quigley. Quigley's analysis of elements in German character which were exported to us occurs in his book, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. Quigley traced what he called the German thirst for the coziness of a totalitarian way of life to the breakup of German tribes in the Great Migrations 1,500 years ago. When pagan Germany finally transferred its loyalty to the even better totalitarian system of Diocletian in post-Constantine Rome, that system was soon shattered too. a second tragic loss of security for the Germans. According to Quigley, they refused to accept this loss. For the next 1,000 years, Germans made every effort to reconstruct the universal system, from Charlemagne's Holy Roman Empire right up to the aftermath of Jena in 1806. During that 1,000-year interval, other nations of the West developed individual liberty as the ultimate center of society and its principal philosophical reality. But while Germany was dragged along in the same process, it was never convinced that individual sovereignty was the right way to organize society. Germans, said Quigley, wanted freedom from the need to make decisions. The negative freedom that comes from a universal totalitarian structure which gives security and meaning to life. The German is most at home in military, ecclesiastical, or educational organizations, ill at ease with equality, democracy, individualism, or freedom. This was the spirit that gave the West forced schooling in the early 19th century. So spare a little patience while I tell you about Prussia and Prussianized Germany, whose original mission was expressly religious, but in time became something else. During the 13th century, the Order of Teutonic Knights set about creating a new state of their own. After 50 turbulent years of combat, the order successfully Christianized Prussia by efficient methods of exterminating the entire native population and replacing it with Germans. By 1281, the order's hold on lands once owned by the heathen Slavs was secure. Then, something of vital importance to the future occurred. The system of administration selected to be set up over these territories was not one patterned on the customary European model of dispersed authority, but instead was built on the logic of Saracen centralized administration, an Asiatic form first described by crusaders returned from the Holy Land. For an example of these modes of administration in conflict, we have Herodotus' account of the Persian attempt to force the pass at Thermopylae. Persia, with its huge, bureaucratically subordinate army, arrayed against self-directed Leonidas and his 300 Spartans. This romantic image of personal initiative, however misleading, in conflict with a highly trained and specialized military bureaucracy, was passed down to 60 generations of citizens in Western lands as an inspiration and model. Now, Prussia had established an Asiatic beachhead on the northern fringe of Europe, one guided by a different inspiration. Between the 13th and 19th centuries, the Order of Teutonic Knights evolved by gradual stages into a highly efficient secular civil service. In 1525, Albert of Brandenburg declared Prussia a secular kingdom. By the 18th century, under Frederick the Great, Prussia had become a major European power in spite of its striking material disadvantages. From 1740 onwards, it was feared throughout Europe for its large, well-equipped, and deadly standing army, comprising a formulaic 1% of the population. After centuries of debate, the 1% formula became the lot of the United States military, too, a gift of Prussian strategist von Clausewitz to America. By 1740, the mature Prussian state structure was almost complete. During the reigns of Frederick I and his son Frederick II, Frederick the Great, the modern absolute state was fashioned there by means of immense sacrifices imposed on the citizenry to sustain permanent mobilization. The historian Thomas Macaulay wrote of Prussia during these years, "The king carried on warfare as no European power ever had. He governed his own kingdom as he would govern a besieged town, not caring to what extent private property was destroyed or civil life suspended. The coin was debased, civil functionaries unpaid, but as long as means for destroying life remained, Frederick was determined to fight to the last." Close quote. Goethe said Frederick, quote, "saw Prussia as a concept, the root cause of a process of abstraction consisting of norms, attitudes, and characteristics which acquired a life of their own. It was a unique process, supra-individual, an attitude depersonalized, motivated only by the individual's duty to the state, close quote. Today, it's easy for us to recognize Frederick as a systems theorist of genius, one with a real country to practice upon. Under Frederick William II, Frederick the Great's nephew and successor, from the end of the 18th century on into the 19th, Prussian citizens were deprived of all rights and privileges. Every existence was comprehensively subordinated to the purposes of the state, and in exchange, the state agreed to act as good father, giving food, work, and wages suited to the people's capacity, welfare for the poor and elderly, and universal schooling for children. The early 19th century saw Prussian state socialism arrive full-blown as the most dynamic force in world affairs, a powerful rival to industrial capitalism, with antagonisms sensed but not yet clearly identified. It was the moment of schooling, never to surrender its grip on the throat of society once achieved. And I'm reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. The devastating defeat by Napoleon at Jena triggered the so-called Prussian reform movement, a transformation which replaced cabinet rule by appointees of the national leader with rule by permanent civil servants and permanent government bureaus. Ask yourself which form of governance responds better to public opinion, and you will realize what a radical chapter in European affairs was opened. The familiar three-tier system of education emerged in the Napoleonic era, one private tier, two government ones. At the top, one half of 1% of the students attended Akademienschulen, where, as future policymakers, they learned to think strategically, contextually, in wholes. They learned complex processes and useful knowledge, studied history, wrote copiously, argued often, read deeply, and mastered tasks of command. The next level, Realschulen, was intended mostly as a manufactory for the professional proletariat of engineers, architects, doctors, lawyers, career civil servants, and other such assistants as policy thinkers at times would require. From 5 to 7.5% of all students attended these real schools, learning in a superficial fashion how to think in context, but mostly learning how to manage materials, men, and situations, to be problem solvers. This group would also staff the various policing functions of the state, bringing order to the domain. Finally, at the bottom of the pile, a group between 92 and 94% of the population attended people's schools, where they learned obedience, cooperation, and correct attitudes, along with the rudiments of literacy and official state myths of history. This universal system of compulsion schooling was up and running by 1819 and soon became the eighth wonder of the world, promising for a brief time, in spite of its exclusionary layered structure, liberal education for all. But this early dream was soon abandoned. This particular utopia had a different target than human equality. It aimed instead for frictionless efficiency. From its inception, the Volksschulen, the people's place, heavily discounted reading. Reading produced dissatisfaction, it was thought. The Bell School remedy was called for. A standard of virtual illiteracy formally taught under state church auspices. Reading offered too many windows onto better lives, too much familiarity with better ways of thinking. It was a gift unwise to share with those permanently consigned to low station. Heinrich Pestalozzi, an odd Swiss-German school reformer, was producing at this time a non-literary, experience-based pedagogy, strong in music and industrial arts, which was attracting much favorable attention in Prussia. Here seemed to be a way to keep the poor happy without arousing in them hopes of dramatically changing the social order. Pestalozzi claimed the ability to mold the poor to accept all the efforts peculiar to their class. He offered them love in place of ambition, by employing psychological means in the training of the young, class warfare might be avoided. A curiously prophetic note for the future development of scientific school teaching was that Pestalozzi himself could barely read. Not that he was a dummy. Those talents simply weren't important in his work. He reckoned his own semi-literacy an advantage in dealing with children destined not to find employment requiring much verbal fluency. 17 agents of the Prussian government acted as Pestalozzi's assistants in Switzerland, bringing insights about the Swiss style of schooling home to northern Germany. While Pestalozzi's raggedy schools lurched clumsily from year to year, a nobleman, von Fellenberg, refined and systematized the Swiss reformer's disorderly notes, hammering the funky ensemble into clarified plans for a worldwide system of industrial education for the masses. As early as 1808, this non-academic formulation was introduced into the United States under Joseph Neef, formerly a teacher at Pestalozzi's school. Neef, with important Quaker patronage, became the principal schoolmaster for Robert Owen's pioneering work utopia at New Harmony, Indiana. Neef's efforts there provided high-powered conversational fodder to the fashionable Unitarian drawing rooms of Boston in the decades before compulsory legislation was passed. And when it did pass, all credit for the political victory belonged to those Unitarians. Neef's influence resonated across the United States after the collapse of New Harmony. Through lectures given by Robert Owen's son, later a congressman, then referee of J.P. Morgan's legal contretemps with the U.S. Army, and through speeches and intrigues by that magnificent 19th century female dynamo Scottish emigre Fanny Wright, who demanded the end of family life and its replacement by communitarian schooling. The tapestry of school origins is one of paths crossing and recrossing, and more apparent coincidences than seem likely. Together, Owen and Wright created the successful Working Man's Party of Philadelphia, which seized political control of that city in 1829. The party incorporated strong compulsion schooling proposals as part of its political platform. Its idea to place working-class children under the philosophical discipline of highly skilled craftsmen, men comparable socially to the yeomanry of pre-enclosure England, would have attracted favorable commentary in Philadelphia, where banker Nicholas Biddle was locked in struggle for control of the nation's currency with working-class hero Andrew Jackson. Biddle's defeat by Jackson quickly moved abstract discussions of a possible social technology to control working-class children from the airy realms of social hypothesis to policy discussions about immediate reality. In that instant, maximum tension between an embryonic financial capitalism and a populist republic struggling to emerge, the Prussian system of pedagogy came to seem perfectly sensible to men of means and ambition. And I've been reading from John Taylor Gatto's The Underground History of American Education. Gatto taught for 30 years in the New York City schools. In the end, he left teaching because he became convinced that schools were destroying the minds and characters of children. Gatto has become one of the foremost advocates of homeschooling and self-directed learning. You can find out more about his work and also download this entire book for free at his website, johntaylorgatto.com. That's Gatto with two T's. And you can download an MP3 or podcast of this and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests at our website, unwelcomeguests.org. And our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Come get